Hello, friends. This is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM in Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. Today, actually, I'm broadcasting by Skype from a UFO conference in Yelm, Washington, and it's going to be a lot of fun. I'll be bringing on Randy Kramer during the first hour. He was part of the Secret Space Program, and I know that Randy will have lots of interesting things to say. The purpose of Out of This World Radio is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place, and I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this earth a much better place. I want to thank everyone so much for making Out of This World Radio one of the most popular talk shows in the Seattle area and the fastest growing metaphysical and spiritual radio program in the world with over 200,000 listeners in over 80 countries. During the first hour, I'll be interviewing Randy Kramer, the Secret Space Program, and during the second hour, from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Seattle time, I'll be interviewing Bob Satiakam on the importance of water. Bob's a wonderful man. He's Native American, and I know we'll have lots of interesting things to talk about. But before we start, I'd like to thank everyone's support for this radio program, because Out of This World Radio is a nonprofit program supported entirely by donations. And for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button, at the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I really appreciate your help and support, because I know together we can and will create a much better and happier world. I also want to thank the many sponsors of this show, and we're also looking for sponsors as well. Any advertising on the program will have a worldwide audience for your goods and services. With that, I'd like to thank my dear friend Carol, who's been signing my website, providing wonderful support, my friends in the Galactic Alliance who've been supporting my show, my angelic and earthly family, and of course, Eric, both Erics at KKNW, without whose help and support this program would not be possible. I have a spiritual mentoring program for those interested, where I can teach people how to contact their angels and spirit guides. If you'd like to get in touch with your loved ones who've passed on or contact your guides and get some good spiritual advice, please email me at outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. Or you can also call me in the United States at 509-750-9793 or toll-free at 1-888-879-8339. A dear friend of mine passed away a few days ago. His name is Wally Brown. He lived in the Yelm area. He had a heart of gold, and I just wanted to ask everyone listening today to please send lots of love and light to him and his family. He was a wonderful man, and he will be missed. Also, if you missed my Galactic Wisdom Conference this year, you can order the audios and some videos of the conference. If you'd like to do that, please email me at outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. My next conference, the Galactic Wisdom Conference, will be held at the same location in Olympia, Washington, from April 12th to the 16th, 2019, and the website is www.galacticwisdomconference.com. Among the people coming to the conference, to my next Galactic Wisdom Conference, will be a famous naturopathic physician named Dr. Kara Rocha from the Bahamas, as well as Erin Elizabeth. She's the director of Health Nut News, and she's a wonderful person. She'll be coming up from Florida to give a presentation at my conference. In addition, in September 6th to the 12th, I'll be taking a group of people to Mount Shasta, Telos, and the Hollow Earth. I've been sponsoring trips to Mount Shasta and Telos and the Hollow Earth for several years now, and it's a wonderful opportunity to visit this special place. I think Mount Shasta is one of the most spiritual places in the world. And at Shasta, we always see Sasquatch and UFOs flying around the mountain. One thing I have to tell you is that I was there last month, and when we were there last month, the Sasquatch visited our campsite, and they created a beautiful peace mandala made up of branches, tree branches, and pink and clear rose quartz crystals. They told me that the crystals actually came from the Hollow Earth. Several people in my group also saw Sasquatch walking around in the trees around our campsite, and they kind of appeared in this third dimension, and then they would suddenly disappear into another higher dimension. And from what I know, they've been around here on this planet between 300 and 400,000 years. They predate Atlantis, and they also are interdimensional beings who can easily go from this third dimension into fourth or even fifth dimension. They're amazing creatures, and they're very benevolent. In September of 2017, there was an instance where one of the members of my group, Tammy from Minnesota, came and she'd been crippled for she'd been crippled for decades, and the Sasquatch surrounded her van where she was sleeping in one night, and they asked her if she wanted a healing, and she said, yes, I'd love a healing. So the next thing she knows is that her benevolent friends from the Hollow Earth come around, a UFO appears on top of her van, and then the she's beamed aboard this UFO craft, and they heal her legs. And then they put her back in the van, and she wakes up the next morning, and she's literally running around the campsite, totally healed. Her legs have been healed ever since. And she was one of the miracle stories that happened then. I know that in 2016, when I took a group of people to Mount Shasta, there was another lady who'd had fibromyalgia. She's had that for many years, and they healed her. It was gone by the time she left. So I'm not saying this happens every time you go to Mount Shasta, but there's a lot of benevolent beings there, and it's an amazing trip. You have to follow certain spiritual protocols before you go. And if you are interested, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. The cost is only $200 and includes free camping right on the mountain, which I've already paid for. With that, I'd like to bring on my first guest, Randy Kramer, of the Secret Space Program. I think Randy's stuck in traffic. Here he is. Good. Hey, Randy, it's good to see you. I'm glad you made it. You found it okay?
I did. I'll be back. My GPS
landed right here. Okay, good. Well, please have a seat, Randy. Yeah, have a seat. But first, before we start with Randy, I'd like to introduce Michiko Hayashi of the Emoto Peace Project, because Michiko, I was going to have her on with Bob Satayakim at 3 o'clock, but she has to go and give another presentation here at the at this UFO conference. So I wanted to introduce Michiko briefly, and then we'll bring Randy on the air. Michi, hi. So glad you could make it here today.
Thank you so much, Ted, for having me here again.
Yes. Well, tell us about the importance of water, because that's briefly. I know you can't stay for the full second hour, but tell us a little bit about the importance of water and how to.
Okay. Well, as Dr. Emoto discovered, water is life, and water shows everything, whether the energy is good or bad, in a form of crystals. And many people are not aware yet that everything is hado. Our emotions are, hado means vibration, energy, and our emotions also are vibration, hado. And so when we are upset or when we are happy, the water shows whether our emotions are positive or not. And when it's positive, then water makes beautiful crystals. And that means we are 70% water. So if we are in the state of happiness or love and gratitude, then we are healthy and happy, and that affects everyone around us and also the environment.
Tell us about your hado machines. I think that's something people don't really know much about.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Dr. Emoto before he started doing the research on water, he was the doctor of alternative medicine. He treated more than 10,000 clients with the machine called MRA, Magnetic Resonance Analyzer. And what he did was he detected the root cause of the problems people had and imprinted information to cancel out those negative information, the root cause of the problems that that patient had, and had everyone drink their own personal water. And that's how he treated. And now I brought the newest version of a hado machine, vibrational machine, that Yoshi, who is the developer and also who is the Dr. Emoto's first student and the best student, who has been treating people more than 20,000 people in this past 23 years. And so this time I'm happy to give up trial of therapy, hado therapy, vibrational therapy, using this one of the most recent device. Okay, and that's a trial, so it takes about 25 minutes, and I will imprint and make the personalized water for the people, and I think I can do it up to maybe six people, and it takes about 25 minutes, and I'm charging only $25, and that money will go to Emoto Peace Project to donate to support.
Okay, so you're doing that this weekend, and then when does this when does your offer end? I guess when you go back next week?
I'm leaving here on early morning of Tuesday, so I can do it tomorrow, maybe tonight. Today probably I can't because I'm giving my presentation. But tomorrow after 1:30 or 2 o'clock I will be available. So please email maybe Ted or call you. Maybe, is that okay?
Sure. You can call me at 509-750-9793 or email me at outofthisworld1150@gmail.com.
Okay, and thank you, Ted. I will be able to do that tomorrow or Sunday, up to six people, because I brought water for six people. Okay,
okay.
Thank
right.
you.
Okay. Well, Michiko, I know you have another presentation this afternoon here in Yelm, but if you could stay as long as possible, that'd be great.
I would like to hear what Randy says.
Oh, Randy's a great guy, and I'm so happy. I got a little worried earlier, Randy, that when you talked about your GPS giving you the wrong directions. Were you headed to Mexico at the time when you realized you were going the wrong direction?
Oh, no, I was getting the right directions. It was just giving me a slightly later time. Traffic has just been awful coming up I-5. It was bad last year, and it wasn't great this year, and I tried to leave in early enough time, but it was still just putting me a little bit behind, but I made it in pretty good time, actually.
Okay, well, that's great. That's great. We have a little microphone here, Randy, and I think when I get some money ahead, I'm going to buy a much better microphone for my show.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. Well, you've had a fascinating career. You spent 20 years in the Marine, in the Secret Space Program, and then you did a lot of things. You went to the moon, and then you went to Mars for 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you initially told your story, a story under the synonym of Captain K. Captain K. And you say you were only 4 years old when you began training for the Secret Space Program. Tell us about that.
I was about age four. I mean, as I've explained from the ground up, I was genetically engineered in a laboratory and essentially built from the ground up. There are a lot of different programs to make what we call augmented soldiers, what some people refer to as super soldier programs, but I never really liked the term. And so we refer to them as augmented soldier programs. And the earliest augmented soldier programs were taking fully adult participants or subjects and bending them, shaping them, using gene therapy and a bunch of other things to try and make them better. At some point, someone just decided that you would get a much better end result product if you started from scratch, if you started from when they were kids, when they were infants, if you just went to the very drawing board and started with taking a genome that you wanted to make and building that person up from scratch. So we won't go into the complexities at this point on why that still means I have a soul and I'm not just a clone or a robot or some kind of synthetic person.
I want to tell everyone, Randy definitely seems quite human. So
yeah. I was definitely made still in such a way with, you know, human birth parents I was the complexities of soul science. I'm not even going to try and talk about right this minute, but I still have one. And so I'm still completely human. But I was built from the ground up. And so training really, you know, starts almost at the get-go from the beginning of wherever they can start with neurobiological development. But I want to say that physical training exercises started around age four. Yeah, that's correct.
That's amazing. Now, tell us a little bit about Mars. You know, they call it the red planet here. We've all seen sci-fi movies about Mars, and there's monsters who live there. But what's it really like? Is it a little bit like Arizona in the desert where it's very hot, blue skies? Or are there really green men living on Mars, Randy?
No green men that I personally have seen. The atmosphere, depending on where you are, can be either very warm or very cold. My visit to the equatorial region, I would say that it was pretty temperate, mild climate there. I've heard people say that it can actually get hot down there, but that's not where I spent the bulk of my time. The bulk of my time I spent in a pretty far northerly location that we would I often refer to as Alaska, in the sense that we're talking, you know, way more than, you know, almost two-thirds of the way towards the pole. So very far north to the point where you didn't want to go outside without an environment suit, which we used all the time. So it was very cold up there. Very, 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 very cold. You could die from exposure most of the year round if you were exposed to the atmosphere raw out there. It was very cold.
I have to ask you this, Randy. There's all kinds of stories about Mars' ancient history. And did you see any – are there indigenous humans living on Mars? Or who lives on Mars? What kinds of animal and plant life do they have?
I've heard people talking about indigenous Homo sapiens who live there, but I've never met them. In the region that we were at, there was a certain amount of wild animal life that comes in the forms of small birds, small reptiles, small snakes, small mammals, burrowing mammals, mostly small stuff because of the cold and the temperature doesn't pretty much allow for the large critters to roam around. Again, towards the equatorial region, I'm understanding that they get pretty big. But up as far north as we were, there was a lot of things that were tiny. The indigenous species that we dealt with was an indigenous reptoid species and an indigenous insectoid species. So my understanding, there are at least four or five indigenous species that are from different genome types. So, you know, an insectoid type, a reptoid type, a couple sapien types, and a fourth or fifth type, which I'm not real familiar with, but is like a smaller, I won't say like a zeta or a gray type, but a smaller, petiter, larger headed, evolved being that's, you know, bipedal, you know, two arms, two legs, two eyes, but not necessarily based on a humanoid or a human or a mammalian ape subject or source like we are.
Wow, that's amazing to know, learn about that. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen this, but in years past, they always had news stories about whether there was life on other planets and life on Mars. And here you're, matter of fact, he's saying, yeah, there's all kinds of life on Mars.
Well, and anyone who's paying attention to the news right now, we have a new piece of information that's been released where they found an underground lake on Mars. That's very recent. That's going around the mainstream media right now. So we're inching towards. A few years ago, they inched us towards by saying that they had running water. And the scientific definition at that time of what they meant by running water is, you know, droplets of water forming in the most low pressure situation that will dribble down a hill or something and form larger droplets. But that was what they were technically referring to as having condensed running water that would occur naturally. And then about a year later, NASA came out with a report that I call a page D12 story, which means, referring back to the old days when people read newspapers, page one is A1, and then you have sections B, C, D, and page 12, and section D is something that most people would never read. So if it's
back near the obituary.
Yeah, so if it came up on page D12, most people never read it. And so this was a story that popped up on a few websites, and NASA made a pretty, like, several pages worth of press release about it. But I've mentioned it and talked to a number of people about this, and most of them have never read it. So I feel like I'm one of the five people who actually read the story when it came out. But it came out about a year after they admitted running water. And the second story that came out was essentially that they had found, using the gas spectrometer telescopes, gaseous formations of water and oxygen within the atmosphere. There was no real mention of like what quantities or ratios or so forth. But the sentence that always stuck out to me, which was from in the director of NASA's own words as he typed the report, said that we may have to accept that Mars has livable atmosphere right now. And that's a huge variation from what we've been talking about, there being barely maybe bacterial life or nothing living. So now we've just gone and we've gone an extra inch now. So now we're like, we've got droplets of running water, potentially livable atmosphere. Now we have a condensed form of water in the form of an underground lake. So we're just going to keep getting those bits of information every year or so until they decide that they want us to know that there's, you know, dinosaur-sized reptiles or mammals running around down in the equatorial regions, or conscious sentient life running around. They're going to they'll wait for that. But we're getting, you know, a little bit more as we go every year or so.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, Randy, people who've come out in public and talked about this before have been eliminated or found an early demise. but so I want to congratulate you for sharing this information and having the courage to tell people what you did and what's out there.
Oh, and staying alive. Thank you. Well, there's always a couple different classes of people who want to bring out information. You have people who are sometimes referred to as completely unsanctioned whistleblowers who are blowing the whistle on something that they know but are not given permission by the people that they used to work for to do so. Those are the highest percentage of people that disappear or end up, you know, quote unquote, I'm going to make the air quotes that you can't see, you know, committing suicide in a motel room somewhere. And then you have people who are given sanction but still called whistleblowers because they're not telling people that they have official permission from the people that they used to work for, but they do essentially, and they manage to come out and say, no, I'm a whistleblower trying to tell the truth. I have said very, very clearly that the command staff of United States Marine Corps Special Section has straight up given me permission. So I technically am not a whistleblower. I'm technically a person who has been given permission by the command staff, the recognized military authority chain of command, which I am under, to discuss this publicly. So that gives me quite a bit more protection and room to wiggle in without someone being able to, you know, hit me up the side of the head with a baseball bat or quote unquote have me commit suicide in a motel room. So I will probably be around longer than most for that reason, because I was given some official permission. That doesn't mean I still don't come under some assault and attack in my life, but I think I'm doing pretty well, and I'm pretty lucky in that sense.
On behalf of all my listeners worldwide, I want to thank you and your commanders especially for coming out and helping the people of this planet understand that there's more to life out there than just what's here on this planet.
We think it's imperative. We think that group consciousness, mass consciousness, understanding that there's something bigger and greater going on out there is what will elevate us to social awareness, to understanding that we're not alone, which is a huge step when you think about the larger public admission by governments, representatives, systems of authority to actually come to when they get to that point where they're going to, we're not really alone? Okay, now let's deal with that. The moment that that actually happens is a huge consciousness, mental, emotional shift for everybody on the planet. At this point, because it's not officially sanctioned by those people, you have this growing, inching change and shifting in consciousness and awareness as people are paying attention to stories like my own and other people's in order to go, maybe there is something really going on out there. So it's that slow change, that slow shift that they try and inch forward to keep everything from breaking all at once. There's certainly some concern that if you came out all at once in 1965 or 1970 and told everybody the truth, you could have, you know, mass panic. And truth is, we absolutely have. Well, I will go even back farther than that to Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast, which had people getting in their cars and literally heading to the mountains and running for the hills and panicking that we were actually being invaded from another world. So it's been demonstrated that there were times in the past if the general public thought that something like that was going on, they absolutely panicked. But you also, it wasn't just we're being visited, it was we're under attack by Martians, you know, on a radio broadcast, so that caused a little more panic. But it was also, I would suggest, on purpose to test that very, very theory of what would happen. And so I think statistically what's showing, what we're seeing now is as we get farther along in time and space, the less likely something like that would happen, and the closer we're getting to the point where when you do have an official admission, you're going to have a significant percentage of the population, two-thirds, three-quarters or more, that will just go, I knew that already. And that's what they're hoping for, is by the time they have an official admission, instead of having a shock value to a large percentage of the population, you'll have a larger percentage of the population that will just say, I knew that already.
Well, I think it's safe to say that most Americans support, a clear majority support your efforts and your commander's efforts for disclosure, which is good.
We don't have any official numbers on that, but I think we're feeling pretty good about that, yeah, that we have quite a bit of support, yeah, definitely, mentally, emotionally, psionically, physically.
What do you think of President Trump's call the other day for a separate secrets, a space branch of the military? Do you think there's already a separate branch?
There's several. As I sometimes when I have this conversation with people, I start them out slow. And I say, like, are you aware that there's Air Force Space Command? Air Force Space Command, if you Google them, they have a website. They'll tell you about what they're doing as far as satellite rocket launches. But they don't tell a ton about what they're doing. I would suggest that any military organization is going to have that isn't a complete special access program or unacknowledged special access program, is going to tell you a little bit about what they do. And then there's going to be a whole bunch that they do that they're not going to tell you that they do. So if you presume that Air Force Space Command is doing more than what they're telling you, you can presume that there's a tip of the iceberg and then there's what's below the iceberg. And then and we go next in that line of conversation, I say, because some people have heard of Air Force Space Command, a lot of people haven't, then I won't mention, are you aware that there is Naval Space Command? Now, Naval Space Command is another one. You can Google them and look them up, and you will find even less information about them on the internet. You will find who the current commanding officer is, I think an address in Virginia, and very little information about what Naval Space Command is up to. So again, I would suggest that they are up to a certain amount of what they're telling people that they're up to, and then a whole lot of what they're not telling what their people are up to. And then you go another step on that. United States Marine Corps Special Section is a USAP. It's an unacknowledged special access program. So you can Google that, and the only thing you're going to come up with is me, because that's another level of covert military space program arm of the military. So you have at least two admitted branches that have their own space programs, call them space commands, and I would suggest that they're up to a whole lot more than what they're saying that they're up to. And then you certainly have other branches who have covert space command programs who are not talking at all about what their space command or space programs are doing.
How about the Army?
Oh, the Army would certainly have its own covert operations in special forces training for military options in space defense. I couldn't say what their main interest in other space launches of satellites, rockets, or other craft are. I think it's minimal. I think probably the three largest organizations militarily that are participating would be the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps.
I have Simon Parks on my show on a regular basis, and something Simon told me some months ago, I want to share it with you and my listeners. He said that as he said, there's a reason why President Trump surrounded himself with only U.S. Marine generals and Army generals, but no admirals. You didn't see the admirals there from the naval forces. And that was because the Army and the Marines had the least contact with extraterrestrials and their control. And he said that they had their most free will. That's what he was told me, and you being a military man might have some insight on that, being part of the Marines.
I would suggest that when you start drawing hash marks or slices of pie in a pie chart to try and explain which specific agencies and which specific departments in the branches of the military operating under covert military space program activities have friendly relationships and or dysfunctional and or controlling relationships with extraterrestrials, that becomes a very complicated pie. So I wouldn't even try to analyze that slices of pie right now, other than to say that could, in a very general sense, be true. In a very general sense, I wouldn't suggest that every person in the Navy who is a member of covert military space program activities is being manipulated or controlled, but you may have a percentage of which certain other members within the intelligence community have less trust over. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are not trustworthy. It just means that people who are in the filtering process of deciding which information to be trusted and not trusted and to be acted upon are more suspicious of people who are more involved with direct communications or direct involvement with extraterrestrials. It's a natural paranoia and a natural suspicion among human beings to sort of behave that way, I think. And so naturally at this moment, the filtering process with the military intelligence community is to be more filtering and more concerning about anybody who seems to have too friendly of a status with extraterrestrial partners or friends than those who tend to be more terrestrially focused. And again, that's not a guarantee. Anyway, it goes down the road, but I can see why if you've got 200 different slices of pie that you're trying to decide what's the best information to go on, and you can't really decide every factor. You're just going to start eliminating things that you're not sure about. And so when you start talking about the intentions of extraterrestrial species, it gets complicated and it gets fuzzy. And so it's an easy thing to say, I don't know what these people really want or really up to, so let's just kind of put them all on this side of a line of being more suspicious of, because we don't know. It's more question marks, so let's just be more suspicious of that. I can understand why the intelligence community would filter information and filter data in that direction. That makes sense.
Okay, thanks. One thing you mentioned on my show a couple of years ago when you were on, Randy, and it's been too long. Thanks so much for coming on today. Is that when you were at the LOC, Lunar Operations Command, on the dark side of the moon, you mentioned, maybe it was you or Corey Good, I can't remember, but I think it was you who mentioned that you had a special bed. Have you heard about this in the medical facilities up there, which changes, if someone, for example, has cancer, they change the vibration of the bed to cure that person's cancer? Have you heard about that, or tell me about the medical facilities?
There are certainly some people who have been discussing some different medical technologies. What we had access to in the MDF on Mars was something called a holographic cellular regenerating medical bed, or what is often just abbreviated or shortened to as a holobed. And it uses a combination of a computer program, which is able to analyze a blood sample of the subject that you're using and get a perfect genetic mapping of what that person should look like genetically, that can actually compute that and then create a 3D model that's projected with a hologram over the person to restore damaged tissue, or in some cases to actually regrow lost tissue. So if you get a hand blown off, which in my case has happened many times, that they're able to just grow it right back. Or if you get third degree burns or an organ that's severely damaged, they can repair the cells in that organ or over the tissue fairly quickly.
That's pretty amazing. Do you think someday we'll get that technology down here on planet Earth?
If I have anything to say about it, we will. I have a chief engineer now, and we have been discussing the development from the ground up of this technology and the holobed technology. And we definitely understand, as far as on paper, what we want to do, what the components are that we need to do to put this larger device together, the software elements, the hardware elements. Based on the current industrial development of holographic projection technology, where we need to go from, let's call that point A, the where we are right now, and where we want to be, the point C, to be able to make a usable, safe device, we fully understand where that is on paper. The issue is certainly funding a project that large, which is going to require a lot of engineers, which is going to require hardware and software laboratories, manufacturing laboratories, because we're going to have to essentially build, you know, all of our own equipment from the ground up for the most part. We're going to be on the cutting edge of holographic development technology at that point. And then you just have to go through what I consider, as the head of that project, is a safe protocol and a safe procedure. I would never, ever, ever develop that technology and then release it to the public too quickly before we had been able to guarantee that it was safe to use on human beings and wouldn't cause damage of any kind.
Is it possible to ask this theoretical question, Randy? Would it be possible to have immortality with this kind of technology?
It absolutely is. In fact, I'll go a step further to explain how that's used by members of the covert military space program who are using it to extend their lives at this point. So you have a number of personnel within the program who started out as officers back in the 40s, 50s, 60s. Some of them are well over 100 years old right now. And if they were not using this technology to keep them younger, you know, they'd be decrepit or dead by now. But in order, it really became the notion of saving your best, most experienced minds. I mean, you had people who started some of these programs back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, who were brilliant, who had decades worth of experience, and if we had just let them age naturally, we would have lost some of our most brilliant, most experienced personnel to be able to continue to build a covert military space program to hopefully, well, I shouldn't say hopefully, to at some point getting to a place where we will have a overt military space program that we can admit that we have. And without those people, you'd lose time, you'd lose decades of development. And so the technology is used on those people to keep them physically younger. But interestingly enough, we've learned that if you make someone from the neck up too young, like you said, for instance, if you take a 65-year-old person and you regenerate their cellular tissue down to an 18-year-old again, including from what they look in the mirror and they see from the neck up, you have a certain percentage that start having psychological problems because they start acting like 18-year-olds again, because that's what they see when they look in the mirror. Wow. So it actually causes, it can cause a schism. So one of the things that we do is, if you're old enough to get this technology used on you because they want to keep you around long enough, they'll keep the tissue in your body below the neck at a much younger age than from the neck up. You will never from the neck up look less than 55 if you're 65, 75, 85 years old, because they want you to look in the mirror and see that you have some experience and some gray hair and some responsibility, instead of seeing that you're 20 years old again and start going, hey, I'm 20, I can be as irresponsible as I want because I'm going to live for another 80 years. So there is a psychological component to that. And so people who are being kept, their lives extended using that technology so they can continue to serve for decades and decades and decades beyond what would be their normal expectancy, there is a process of not letting them look too young.
Because it sounds like your services had problems with making people look too young before.
It was a problem on some of the first people that they started using it on. They were like, oh, okay, let's, you know, age regress this guy all the way back to 25 and see how that works. And, you know, people start drinking and carousing again. And you have to like, oh, no, we have to, let's age him up another couple of decades and let them be responsible again.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. Well, do these individuals, they live here on the planet, or they live off planet on the moon and Mars, or are they little bit of both?
Largest percentage of covert military space program personnel live off-world, do not live on the confines of planet Earth. They either live on the moon or in stations or ships beyond that. There are some personnel who are terrestrially bound. They live on the planet, but the more than 95% of the personnel are above the stratosphere level.
Do they ever, get a vacation and they come back down to Earth to see family or friends?
My understanding is that most of the time, you have to be either a pretty high-ranking official or access to pretty high-level security clearances before they would let you do that. For the majority of personnel, for security reasons, you get to take vacations in all kinds of other places, but not come back home to Earth. But I will also say that we used simulators when I was in the MDF, and simulators are, I mean, for all... to try and simplify it, it's kind of like plugging yourself into a device like the Matrix, where you're plugging yourself into a computer program. So you are experiencing that virtual reality in a completely real sense. So it was very possible, and I did this often, using a simulator while I was in the MDF on Mars for decades, and taking a walk on the beach, taking a walk in the woods, and having a moment where it felt enough like I was back home to feel grounded enough to not feel like you were completely losing yourself in another world, which is the beginnings of space madness, which can happen either on another world or out in floating around in space. You literally start to psychologically lose your tethering to your connection to your planet, and you can lose your sanity temporarily.
Interesting. Well, this is fascinating. You know, Randy, I've been asking you all these questions. Are there any areas you'd like to talk about?
Well, I'm going to be giving my talk this weekend. We're going to do it on psionics. We're going to do the laws of psionics.
What is psionics for someone who doesn't know?
To simplify psionics, it's your mind powers. So we're going to define that through the laws of physics that we define them at. So the first law of psionics is that all thought produces psionic energy. So essentially, you begin with understanding that every thought, every emotion, everything that comes vibrated out of your brain and your body, Michiko was talking about earlier, these vibrations. Absolutely, there's a laws of physics that govern them that we call the laws of psionics. And so everything you're thinking, everything you're feeling is emanating out from you. And there's a process. I won't probably have time to go over more than the first two or three. I doubt I'll be able to get to the first five laws. But I did an entire lecture on it over a weekend, and I'm going to try and be cramming that down into like a little hour pre-presentation, then in maybe a couple hours worth of seminar on Sunday to try and teach what I can about the subject in using a very, very short amount of time to present what is normally a lot of information. So I'm going to have to condense it down quite a bit. But essentially, we'll be talking about the laws themselves so people can understand that there's science, math, physics behind it, so your left brain can start to understand and go, aha, And then we'll try and talk about things that the right brain understands experientially, so that, as we also will talk about, how hemispheric brainwave connections and vibrations and patterns become very important, why you want the left brain and the right brain to communicate in sort of even amplitudes if you can, so that they're acting as a whole mind. And if we can, so we're going to kind of say we, like there's a bunch of people going to be with me. It's me teaching the class, I guess. So what I'm hoping to do with that is convey a certain amount of information to the left brain, convey a certain amount of information to the right brain, hope that we as a group of everyone who's there will be able to get the left and the right brain communicating in the right way, so that people can comprehend, understand, and perceive what psionics are. And because that becomes the most important thing, is I can give a lecture on it all day long, but that's not going to get people to really understand what it is until they're both their left side, the right side, and a whole-minded experience gives them something that they can go, oh, that really happened, and that understand why that works.
Now, we're very lucky today. We have Michiko Hayashi, the Moto Peace Project. He used to be the assistant to Dr. Emoto. And I want to ask this to both of you. Was Dr. Emoto, when he talked about the water crystals and the power, when you write love and gratitude on the bottle of water, Randy, these beautiful water crystals form, is that an example of psionics, the power of psionics?
Absolutely. I would say that is just an end result of what we understand to be math equations already in play as far as what thoughts and emotions are doing. So that's absolutely seen the other side of the equal sign of this is the result of having mental emotional intent towards something, directed thought or directed psionic thought or directed psionic projection.
Fantastic, interesting. Michiko, do you have any questions of Randy?
Oh, about vibration?
Vibration, how do Dr. Models work? You're really talking about the same.
I know. These days, a lot of people are talking about the same thing, and I'm so happy that you're here, we're here together, and we're sharing the same thing. But what Dr. Emoto did was something that we can see, the vibration, that's a visualization of a vibration, he said. But until about several years ago, some of the physicians or scientists ridiculed, saying that, how can water have memory? How can water be so be conscious? And we are, everything is vibration. Water observes that vibration, you know. So I'm just very happy that you're here and talk about this psionics.
Oh, thank you. And what we're certainly understanding over time is that what a certain amount of people in mainstream medicine or science rebuke or reject, they eventually come along as the evidence starts to prove them to them. A dear friend of mine who has passed away, Anna Weiss, who really was a pioneer in the work of understanding brainwaves as consciousness and understanding what the left and right brain waves are doing as a whole-minded effect, and used a device, an EEG device called the Mind Mirror, to demonstrate that. And she started out her career going to EEG conferences, being yelled at, ridiculed, told that, you know, she needed to leave the room and being a pariah, to later in her career being on discussion panels and being completely respected as someone who was doing real work with EEG to show what brain waves were doing in a more complicated way than what most medical EEG was doing at the time. So there was definitely a transition from the early days of, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, to later on, hey, would you sit on our panel and help everybody understand what we're doing? So I think we're, you know, the Dark Ages became the Renaissance, became the Age of Enlightenment for the same reason. You had a certain amount of people that just went, no way. And then eventually they sort of go, well, okay, maybe. And then like, well, all right, we're on board now. So I think we're just at that place where we're transitioning a lot of people from, you know, ridicule and questioning to being on board, because we have a lot of evidence to show them. We have a lot of science and a lot of math that can actually verify what we're talking about, instead of, and I know some people will hate me for saying this, instead of just talking about these things in an airy-fairy way, which is being very ephemeral about it or being very right brain about it, lest I say anything else, which is not bad, which is not wrong. It's just that doesn't convince a lot of people. That's, you want to convince a majority of people, you have to get them to understand left and right brain components, and what we'll be able to demonstrate is the whole-minded understanding of any subject or topic.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Well, that's incredible. Well, I think it comes down to vibration. I don't want to speak for you, Michi, but I know Dr. Emoto used to say that everything is hado, or vibration, and in order to heal somebody, you have to change the vibration. And then the technology you talked about, Randy, in the Secret Space program, they use a holographic image and a computer to read to, like, if you lose your, you said something interesting earlier. You said you've lost your hand a couple times and they regrew it?
Oh, I've had body parts blown apart many, many times. My entire body, like hundreds, you know, well over 1,000 times has been damaged, you know, which should have been to deadly, you know, results, mortal results. But that technology is allowed to grow back hands, feet, arms, legs, most of my entire body. I mean, yeah, lots and lots and lots of times.
Wow, wow. Now, is there any negative side of that? Let's say you regrew a hand, for example. Will it age normally like any other part of your body, or is it...
Oh, yeah. I mean, once you restore the cells to the vibration that you're telling them to be restored to, which is what the hologram does, then they will just act normally from that point on. So they'll age normally, they'll be damaged normally again, and you can repair them again and again and again. And so you're just restoring the cells in the body to a baseline. And then if they get damaged again, you bring them back and you restore them to that baseline again using holographic vibration.
I have to ask you this question. My spirit guides asked me to ask you this. Back in the late 50s, there was a gentleman here named Valiant Thor. I'm sure you've heard about him.
Oh, yeah.
And he came from the Galactics. And he offered technology to President Eisenhower at the time, which would have eliminated disease on this planet and given us all free energy. Free energy is, of course, another topic. But with respect to the health issues, one of the people who were against it, was Vice President Richard Nixon, who had friends in the American Medical Association, a lot of doctors, a lot of people he knew in Big Pharma at the time, and he was afraid that their companies would go bankrupt and they'd lose all their jobs because everybody got healthy. If everybody got healthy again today, do you think we'd have that same problem of opposition from those forces? Or I hope it comes, but...
I think you're going to continue to see a certain amount of opposition from forces who would just lose profits. I would call those sort of the less reasonable group of people. There are also people who, I'm going to find myself in a funny position defending Richard Nixon, but he was not wrong to suggest that the immediate implementation of that technology could have bankrupted, you know, many, many hundreds of thousands of people, could have financially crippled the country, could have done an incredible amount of damage by change that happened too quickly. And so I would still be in the camp of saying we need definitely to change things from more functional, from dysfunctional to functional, from more efficient, from less efficient, from just better than using dark ages, invasive surgical technologies, or drugs that, to be honest with you, are like, you know, shooting shotgun pellets at a dartboard where you maybe get some pellets that land in the middle and you hit your target area, and a lot of your pellets land outside the target area. So the drugs are very ineffective in that way. So we need to go to better things. But any implementation of a technology that's too quick or too rapid can certainly upset the balance of a social, of a society or an economy. So I'm just as in favor of some measured implementation of these programs. But what we're seeing right at the moment is just denial of these implementation of these programs. So that's the other extreme of where we don't want to be, is just denying the implementation of them. And the other extreme would be implementing them right away, which could be devastating, to be honest with you. A planet full of completely healthy people with no jobs is a recipe for kind of disastrous consequences, to be honest with you. Yeah. So I absolutely think that there's a median point, a happy median point, where we are implementing these technologies in a functional, healthy way while trying not to do it so quickly as it disrupts the system utterly and entirely. But, you know, I'll be the first person to say that I'm okay if some billionaires lose some money, because most billionaires have more money than they're ever going to need anyway. But I think that when you start talking about how it affects communities, there are certainly communities whose industrial base is singular or dual. It's based on one or two things. And if something greatly disrupts that, you've got an entire community, entire city, town, county of unemployed people, and you have economic devastation at that point. So ending poverty is another area that we can address too, that, you know, in this implementation of these tools and technologies, one of them can be changing our view of how economies work, and so that we can do things like eliminate poverty. When we can eliminate poverty, you can also do things a lot more quickly, so that you're not affecting entire, devastating entire cities and towns and counties economically, because you're ending the poverty process that would make those people have no safety net whatsoever. You create the cushion for which these things can change, and then they can change without devastating entire communities, like, you know, when the auto industry left for Mexico.
Right. Well, that's fascinating. What do you see for the future, Randy? I always like to ask, is there a timeline that your friends, that your good friends in the military, and I want everybody to support them for disclosure. What's their, do they have like a timeline or a plan for giving disclosure, or how, or is it play by ear or whatever?
That's a very good question, and this has been a constantly evolving process, because to say that there's a deadline or a date would presume that there was one person or one committee of people that were in complete control of that date, and that's just not the case. You have far too many voices, committees, command staffs, senior intelligence, military, and government officials who all have a say in the process and all have different reasons for why they want it to go at a certain rate, or what way in which they want that to go, at what time and at what rate. And there's a lot of discussion about how and when that happens based on lots of differences of opinion. So I would liken it to saying like a meeting of the United Nations, where you have a room full of people who all have different interests as far as when something gets done or how it gets done, which is why it's not a simple discussion to say we're doing it, you know, on, you know, January the 5th, 2019, because there's just no way to be that specific and that clear when you have so many different voices and opinions. My Brigadier General has been deeply involved in this process on a regular, consistent, regular basis for the last several years now. And I can say that the happening of meetings and discussions among senior officials on the when and the how have increased and continue to increase, and will continue to be involving as many people as possible, as many voices as possible, as many deciding parties as possible, until we can get some agreement. And we're simply just not going to stop that discussion process or stimulating that discussion process until there is a decision and people can agree on, you know, a window of time or a process of events that will lead to a window of time, which is probably how it's more going to go. Instead of picking a time or a date, it's going to be, here will be the 5 to 10 processes that will occur in order, and then at what point you've processed the 10th, you know, thing is whenever that date will be, is about when your target's going to be.
What can the people of this planet do to support your efforts and your commander's efforts for disclosure?
Well, as I will discuss in the psionics discussion, thinking the right thoughts and feeling the right emotions about it actually is probably the thing that will do the most good and the most positive good. If you want to bring it down to nuts and bolts, talking to people, sharing information. I mean, I certainly talk to enough people who have friends and family who look at them as, you know, the crazy kook in the closet because they believe that there's, you know, extraterrestrials around us, that we have ancient civilizations built by extraterrestrials, and that we have a covert military space program that's in contact with extraterrestrials right now, even though those things are true. So you do have some people who are still struggling with their immediate family groups, social groups, on what they want to believe and what they are ridiculed for believing, and that I encourage people to stand up for what they believe in and to be willing to be the oddball out if that's what it takes in order to. But I would also encourage those people to think smart about how you want to share information. There's information you don't necessarily – if you're a collegiate math student and you have an opportunity to meet a bunch of grade school kids, you don't necessarily start talking about collegiate-level math to them. You probably want to start talking about math to them at a level that they can be interested in and understand in order to stimulate their brains about the further advancement of advanced mathematics, which is going to take them some time to understand. So I would always suggest, if you're starting with friends and family or people around you, start gentle, start slow, start with you know, low-hanging fruit and things that are easy to sort of demonstrate or show massive amounts of evidence for. I always tell people if they want to start the conversation, they go, well, I don't believe that. I say, well, look, just watch the first season of Ancient Aliens, you know, and if you're not convinced after you watch the first season that we have a foundation of extraterrestrial contact on this planet that goes way back, then you're not going to get it at that point. But that's always a good fundamental place to start. start, is that it's not something that happened at Roswell. It's not something that happened in the 60s. It's not something that happened in the 70s. It's something that happened thousands and thousands of years ago the first time.
Randy, you know, you're absolutely fascinating. Would you mind holding past a little bit after the top of the hour? Just a few more minutes, just to give you some more questions.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, we also have Scott Mowry here, a wonderful man who will give us some his views. And please stay tuned to our next hour with Randy Kramer and Scott Mowry and Bob Steik, and we'll be coming in any minute. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening today. Final Frontier.